This is the San Francisco Experience with your host, Jim Herlihy. Independent news commentary with a California perspective. Season 8, Episode 14. The Good Mother, an interview with author Lara Bazelon. Our guest today is Lara Bazelon, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, an attorney, and a writer. The Good Mother is her debut legal thriller novel, which draws on her own professional experience as a former public defender. Set in Los Angeles, The Good Mother is a courtroom drama with many cliff-edged plot twists and turns. It's a story of two young mothers from very different worlds who are forced together in an attorney-client bond. Both women are tenacious, driven, and determined to win at all cost. But above all else, they are both young mothers. Ambitious public defender Abby Rosenberg has recently won a high-profile victory for a controversial gang member when she's assigned a case of a 19-year-old ex-Army wife, Luz Rivera Hollis, who's accused of killing her soldier husband in Germany. Abby takes on this against-all-odds case of an uncooperative and headstrong defendant whose primary goal is to stay out of prison in order to raise her infant daughter. Abby herself struggles to balance her career as a public defender against staying home to take care of her infant son, Cal, and her husband, Nick. Her fellow defender, Will Ellett, gets much too close to the defendant, and Abby has to use all of her savvy wiles, legal training, and courtroom smarts to hold her case and indeed her marriage together. Lara Bazelon holds the Philip and Muriel C. Barnett Chair in Trial Advocacy at the University of San Francisco School of Law, where she is a professor. A former public defender herself, Lara is a mother, a journalist, and an author. She joins us today from San Francisco. Hi, Lara. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Lara, can you share with our listeners a little bit about your background and your biography?
Sure. I was born in Philadelphia to a trial lawyer father and a physician mother. I have three sisters, and believe it or not, out of the four of us, three are lawyers, and the delinquent sister is a PhD. So it was a very hard-charging, high-achieving family.
Yes.
I went to college in law school in New York, and then I clerked for a judge who had a huge influence on me and helped me get my job as a deputy federal public defender in LA, and I worked there for about 7 years. And then I transitioned into academia, and I had a variety of teaching jobs leading to the tenured position that I have now at the University of San Francisco School of Law. And along the way, I got married, I got divorced, and I had two wonderful kids who are 12 and 10.
Now, trial advocacy, of course, is your field at the School of Law. Just for the benefit of our listeners, could you just explain what trial advocacy is, what that discipline entails?
Sure. So my job is to run two different clinics. And what the clinics do is teach students how to be lawyers in the courtroom, how to represent clients. So we're basically a pro bono law firm that's subsidized by the law school. So we have actual clients with real problems and real criminal cases, and we represent them for free. So my job is to teach my students how to do that under my supervision and under the supervision of the professors and staff attorneys that I supervise, and they go into court and they make arguments and they file motions and do all the lawyer stuff with a professor there, making sure at every step of the way that they have the support that they need to be successful. And I chose this particular area of teaching because I had a clinical experience myself when I was in law school that was absolutely critical to my professional development. And I always felt that that experience was the most important experience that I had in law school. And so I really wanted to pay that forward.
very impressive to share that with your students, because that skill to be able to stand up in a courtroom, address the judge confidently, address the jury, defend your client, it's a complex skill, and not many people possess those skills. So very impressed with that background. And of course, that background shows up very clearly in the courtroom scenes in The Good Mother. So why don't we move on to The Good Mother? Because after this impressive career that you've had both in the courtroom and in the classroom, now you've turned your hand to actually writing fiction. And of course, your debut legal thriller novel is The Good Mother. Could you tell us about The Good Mother?
Yes, thank you for asking. And I will also say that this project was a long time in the works, in that I've wanted to be a novelist pretty much since the second grade. And I've written other novels that did not find their way to publication. And I worked on this particular book for about 4 years. Uh-huh. So it was actually a long-held dream of mine to be a published fiction writer. And so the book is very meaningful to me for that reason. And I was particularly interested in telling the story of a hard-charging female trial lawyer who was also a public defender, because I feel like those stories don't often get heard. Mm-hmm. I don't really like the way that public defenders are portrayed generally in the media and in fiction and in film. And I also think that women in particular tend to get overlooked anyway in advocacy roles in the courtroom. So I wanted to showcase that and tell a fictional story, but based on skills that I've seen propelled by women who I know. And then I also wanted to pick a client who was herself very headstrong and determined to make her own decisions, because I think sometimes people see criminally accused folks as kind of disempowered and maybe in the complete thrall of their lawyers, and that's actually not true either.
Well, that's certainly not the case with Luz, because for all of her 19 years, she's a tough cookie. Of course, her mother committed suicide. Her father left home early on in her life, raised by her grandparents in L.A., and of course, went off when she was 17, left her grandmother's home, went to live in Barstow, right, where she met Sergeant Travis Hollis, that she eventually married. So a very independent, tough cookie of a young woman.
She's very tough. She's had a hard life. Her dad left when she was very small and basically remarried and had what she calls his new family and isn't involved in her life. And as you say, her mother took her own life. And so Luz was pretty much on her own except for her grandmother. And they had a somewhat strange relationship. Luz was very rebellious. And she left home, ended up getting a GED. And yeah, she worked underage in a bar, and that's how she ended up meeting her husband. Mm-hmm. And she made a series of choices that led her to this precipice, which is actually how the book starts.
Yes. And then, of course, Abby Rosenberg, who is the public defender, she also lost her father at a young age. He was a trial attorney. He was killed in a car accident. She's a very driven, ambitious woman. Her mother went on to become principal of a high school in Los Angeles. Her brother doesn't really feature in the story, but she also has a brother. But Abby Rosenberg also has come from this fatherless experience and has obviously taken a very different route as an attorney. But again, two very strong, independent women who lost their fathers early on in life. So again, I was taken by both of those characters, very strong characters who really hold your attention throughout the development of the story.
I appreciate you saying that. And I think you're right. There is a tie. And the tie is that they've both been raised to understand that on some level, they're going to be on their own and they need to figure out a way to survive and be independent, because they can't rely on other people. And while they both chose different paths, they're driven by that sense that on some fundamental existential level, they're on their own.
And another way that they're both similar is they're both young mothers. They are, on the one hand, we have Luz, who actually ended up killing the father of her child, whether it was accidental or not. She ended up killing him. And we have Abby, who has just given birth to a child, but her relationship with her husband seems to be on somewhat shaky ground. So, but they're both mothers. It seems like Abby as a mother has a little bit of self-doubt as a mother. Could we talk about that?
She has a lot of self-doubt. And I think part of it is because she's confronting this expectation that's somewhat coming from her partner, Nick, and also I think coming from people at her job and society in general, that having a baby is this transformative experience that's going to turn her into a different person who is much more focused on being at home, completely devoted to her baby, and not as ambitious. And because she didn't have that transformation, she feels, I think, like there's something wrong with her. And she's certainly made to feel like there is something wrong with her by a number of people in this book. And, you know, to be fair, let's just say that some of her parenting choices do actually leave a lot to be desired. And so, yes, I mean, she has doubts, and some of them, I think, are founded and some of them are not.
And then, of course, only a couple of weeks into her maternity leave, she goes back to the office. She goes into her boss and demands to be reinstated as the public defender for Luz Rivera Hollis. And at that point, her boss, Paul, has already reassigned the case to another up-and-coming lawyer who happened to be a military attorney, Will Ellett. And she fights to get back on the case, and she wins.
But, yes, she wins and she loses. She wins in the sense that Paul reluctantly lets her back on. She loses in that Paul, her supervisor, makes a decision that she and Will are going to be equal partners in trying this case, and so she has to actually share it with him, which she does not want to do.
Now, in your experience as a public defender, did you ever come across a case like that where the responsibility for the case was split by the boss between two young attorneys?
That actually in my office was almost always the case. Oh. And it wasn't really two young attorneys. It was generally an attorney who had more trial experience and an attorney who had less that were partnered in cases. Almost never went to trial alone. Although that said, sometimes the more senior person was just sort of what they call a second chair, not really doing very much, but just there in case something went completely off the rails. And then when I was more senior, I took on that role myself. And then I also occasionally was in a real partnership with someone who was basically more or less my level, where we were dividing everything up equally.
Mm-hmm. Now, as Abby comes back to work, her partner, Nick, essentially takes his vacation time and sick leave, et cetera, to stay at home and take care of their baby, Cal. He seems to do pretty good as a stay-at-home dad. And initially, this seems to have been a smart decision between Abby and Nick, her partner. But of course, later on, I guess Nick's patience begins to wear a little bit thin. So his expectation is for her to still play more of a traditional mother role. But at that point, once Abby has gotten back in the saddle of representing her client, she's not going to give that up.
I think that's right. And there's some pretty poor communication between Abby and Nick around the maternity leave. Of course, she promised him she would take all of it, and then she changes her mind very abruptly and sort of springs on him this new idea that he's going to be the one to stay home and essentially forces him into it.
Yes.
And so because of the way she did it, he was not happy and somewhat resentful from the beginning. And I think you can kind of understand why. One of the things I really wanted to do was make it complicated so that it was at times very hard to root for her. And you could understand why her partner was pretty annoyed and also angry. And so, yes, for a while they seem to be doing okay. Her best friend, who's also a man, offers to help and is very, very helpful. And so they sort of are triaging. But then it does go off the rails.
Yeah. Now, let's come back to the underlying case here. We have this young couple, Luz Rivera Hollis, who marries Travis Hollis, who's a master sergeant, and they go out, they're reassigned to Germany. He's, I guess, done a couple of tours in Afghanistan or Iraq. And, turns out that the relationship is somewhat abusive. He is a heavy drinker. There's some violence there. And in addition to that, he also has a former girlfriend, another relationship where they're sexting back and forth and sending emails. And let's talk about that complication in his marriage, his relationship to Luz, his wife, his relationship to his ex-girlfriend, and how the ex-girlfriend factors into the manipulation of the relationship between Luz and Travis, because that's quite a can of worms.
It is quite a can of worms. So, yes, Travis is a complicated person, too. And before he met Luz, he was in love with and together with his high school girlfriend, a woman named Jackie, and the expectations were that they were going to get married. And instead, Travis moved away. He served a tour in Iraq, as you said. And then when he was back stateside and away from Jackie, he fell in love with someone else. He fell in love with Luz, but he was never able to really completely sever ties with Jackie. And then when his father died unexpectedly, he goes home to the funeral from abroad. And because he and Luz are not getting along at all, she doesn't go. And he reconnects with Jackie at the funeral. And then that starts a relationship that, as you say, continues in kind of a spicy way over email.
Yes. Now, I don't know how much of the plot. We don't want to reveal the whole plot here because it is a thriller. There are many twists and turns. And you certainly kept me guessing with the turn of every page. So I'm not going to spill the beans here. But that relationship with Jackie, and it becomes almost a triangular relationship between Luz, Jackie, and Travis, where who's manipulating whom at the end of that relationship. But let's come back to how the book starts off, where Luz makes this emergency phone call on the base, the U.S. Army base in Germany, to the equivalent of 911, and explains that her husband has tried to attack her and that he's bleeding and this and that. From the get-go, we know that there isn't any question that Luz is the killer. Abby has no defense. Abby is dealing with someone who, from the get-go, has been identified as the killer. That's not in doubt.
That's right. The only thing that's in doubt is whether it was justified, whether she acted in self-defense, and perfect self-defense is a complete justification for murder. So if the jury finds that she was truly in fear of her life and in fear of her baby's life, then she's acquitted, and if they don't, then she's convicted.
Now, in this case, in this particular case, Travis, who has a history of heavy drinking, is out drinking till about 2 o'clock in the morning. He comes home, bangs on the door. She opens the door and he confronts her. He ends up being stabbed by her. And this was not the first time that she had been attacked by him. And apparently they would have makeup sex after they had these encounters. It's not an open and shut case that she was in fear of her life and therefore actually having stabbed her husband was justified. That's the kind of subtle turn of this plot which keeps us guessing and which keeps Abby and Will on their toes in trying to defend her, because it's certainly not an open and shut case by any means.
That's true. And actually, if you don't mind, I could read you a tiny piece of what you're talking about from the book, if that's okay with you. So just to set the scene, this is a meeting that Luz has with Will, her male counsel. Abby's not there. She's on maternity leave. And Will is quite desperately trying to get Luz to tell him what happened. And it's in the context of him saying that the government has offered her a plea to manslaughter, and she would do 10 years and be out with good time maybe in 8 years. And she is unwilling to do that, and also unwilling to tell him what happened. And then she goes in a direction that he never fathomed. So this is the end of that chapter. "We have to talk about exactly what did happen," Will says. "You have to tell me." Normally, he would never demand that kind of accounting from a client, believing, like most defense lawyers, that it is better not to know, or to know only what is absolutely necessary. Normally, he does not call his clients to testify. There are too many unknowns, too many risks. It is the government that has the burden. Why help them out by having your client say something really, really stupid, or worse, lie and get caught, which makes the likelihood of a conviction and a bad sentence all the greater? But this is not a normal case. The victim is a decorated combat veteran who drowned in his own blood, and his client is on a recorded call saying she killed him. Will clears his throat and tries again. "If you turn down this deal, we go to trial, and if we don't have a story to tell the jury, a very different kind of story, you will be convicted." "I am not pleading guilty," Lou says. "Never." The vehemence alarms him. That, combined with her refusal to talk about what actually happened, suggests a high degree of irrationality and denial. "I know that 10 years away sounds like forever when you have a baby. I won't have a baby if I go to prison. Travis's mother will get custody." Mm-hmm. She'll take Christina back with her to Ohio. As if reading Will's thought, she adds, "If it comes down to siding between that lady and my grandmother, the judge will pick the white lady who speaks English." Will nods. "It's a real risk, but is that the only reason she's turning down the plea offer?" An answer in response to a question that he would never ask. Instead, he says, "All right, then, we go to trial." "Yes," she agrees. Will takes out his notepad and picks up a pen. He considers asking again about her juvenile conviction, still sealed, and then decides to wait. It's better to go with what's easiest. "Let's talk about your relationship with Travis," he says. "Start from the beginning, when you met him." Luz, ignoring him, has picked up Will's honeymoon picture again and is studying it closely. "What is your wife's name?" she says. Will tries not to look irritated at her pointed refusal to focus. "What's next? A request to look at his wedding album?" "Meredith." "I feel bad for her," Luz says. "I bet she gets jealous." "No, she doesn't," he shoots back defensively, and then, against his better judgment, "Why would you say that? You don't even know her." Luz meets his gaze head on. "Because," she says, "you're so much better than she is." "That is not true," Will insists, a buzzing in his brain like a fly set loose in a closed room. "This woman has no right to speak this way about his marriage." But he feels compelled to protect Meredith against Luz's accusation, and his visceral sense that she might not be wrong. He gives Luz a hard, disapproving stare, pen and notepad forgotten on the desktop. "It is the opposite of what you are saying." Luz shrugs. "Sometimes," she says, "it's hard for people to see what's right in front of them."
You know, and then of course, not to give the story away, and you've sort of set the scene there for Luz and Will having more than just an attorney-client relationship. I'll be discreet.
Yes, she's a very seductive person in many different ways.
Yes, absolutely. And now, also, there's another character here who's very important, and that's her shopping mall lawyer by the name of Estrada, who represented her in the referenced juvenile assault case, who ends up being sentenced to prison by the judge for contempt for not revealing his attorney-client privilege notes in his relationship with Luz, because Luz had lengthy telephone conversations with Estrada, her shopping center lawyer, when she was in Germany in the weeks leading up to Travis's death. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And again, without giving the story away.
Sure. So Mr. Estrada appears early on in the story. As you say, he represented Luz in the past. Will comes to see Mr. Estrada to try to get this file from a conviction that Luz got when she was very young, when she was 16, and Mr. Estrada was her lawyer. And Mr. Estrada won't give Will the file. He says, "You don't have your client's permission," and Will keeps insisting that they're on the same team, and Mr. Estrada keeps telling him that he's not going to give him the file and that maybe Will doesn't want to see what's in the file. And then the judge takes it one step further by calling Mr. Estrada in and telling him, if you don't tell me outside the presence of the jury and outside the presence of the prosecutor what it is your client told you in the months and weeks leading up to her husband's death, I'm going to put you in jail.
Right.
And basically what the judge was trying to figure out was whether there was a crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege, because if you and your client conspire to commit a crime, your communications aren't protected. And so the judge was trying to get to that question, and Mr. Estrada, rather than cooperate, refuses to, and then the judge, in a fit of rage, sentences him to stay in prison until the end of the trial.
Yes. And that is, that relationship with Estrada is something that Abby knows is, Abby senses is probably both a weakness, a fatal flaw, and probably Estrada's silence works to Abby's benefit, would you say? In her defense of
Luz. Yeah, I think she sort of makes that Faustian bargain not to push, thinking that she's probably better off not knowing, but then she's leaving herself and she's leaving Will in the dark about certain crucial things, and that does come back to bite them.
Yes. And then, of course, they roll the dice, they being Abby, Will, and Luz in a conference, they roll the dice whereby when they're agreeing to the plea, they agree that the plea is going to be that the charge is going to be first degree murder. Could you go into that? Because that's a very high stakes gamble, which if they lose is going to put Luz away for the rest of her life. But if they win, she walks. Talk about that, because that kept me on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is something that's very specific to federal court, at least in California. In state court, the judge always gives lesser included instructions. So if you charge somebody with first degree murder, if you're in state court, the jury hears about a second degree murder, a voluntary manslaughter, an involuntary manslaughter, and a criminally negligent homicide. They have all these other options that are less serious on the menu to pick from. Mm-hmm. And that's required. In federal court, it's not required. You can make this decision essentially to go all or nothing and say, well, the government has only argued first degree murder and they're not entitled to instructions that would let the jury compromise. And so this is actually Will's idea to do this. Abby thinks it's a terrible idea because it's as risky as you say. The penalty for first-degree murder in federal court is life in prison without the possibility of parole because there is no parole. Mm-hmm. And so if she's convicted, that's the rest of her life behind bars. The bet is that the jury just won't be able to do that and will allow her to walk away. And it's an extremely high-stakes bet when they could just do the more typical route and hope that the jury would compromise on something like criminally negligent homicide, which might be a couple of years, but not certainly the rest of her life.
But interestingly, you're right. Abby, of course, is reluctant to go that route, but Will argues for it, and Luz, the defendant, embraces it.
Yes. So this is another thing that's sort of interesting. You know, defendants are really allowed to make the major decisions in the case. They get to decide whether or not to testify. They get to decide whether or not to take a plea. It's kind of up to the individual lawyer's discretion what they get to decide about jury instructions. Most lawyers, I think, would say that that's firmly a lawyer decision. That is not a client decision. But in the end, Luz breaks the tie, and mm-hmm. she makes the decision.
Mm-hmm. Luz turns out, for all of her youth, 19 years old, and a GED and a graduate of the school of hard knocks, Luz is incredibly canny. She also knows, and again, not to give the story away, but she knows that the files which Estrada, her former attorney, who's now in prison for not divulging information to the trial judge, she also knows that, or suspects that if that information were to be divulged, that would almost surely condemn her. So she's a very canny, high risk roll of the dice. Although I shouldn't, it's roll of the dice, but it's in a very calculated way that she does. She takes this risk of the first degree murder plea. Very, very impressed with the way that was balanced out there. Because as a reader, you'd say, you know, gee, take the manslaughter plea, take the lesser one, maybe you get 5 years, something like that. But she's a tough cookie and a canny cookie.
And I think she really believes that any amount of time in prison is going to essentially end her relationship with her child, because she thinks that Travis's mom is going to terminate her parental rights and take custody, and that she'll never be a mother again. And so I think rather than risk that, she just decides to go all or nothing.
Then coming back to the motherhood theme between both Abby and Luz, we come back to Abby loses her child, Cal. Nick comes back to the house, and he finds Abby in the bathtub nursing Cal. Abby has fallen asleep. Cal's chin is just above the waterline. Make a long story short, he takes the baby away from her and gets full custody. And so Abby, in the middle of this trial, is now has lost custody of her son. Again, another blow to her estimation of being a good mother, and the self-doubt that she has about being a good mother. And here you have Child Protective Services essentially saying, yeah, she's made some questionable choices here. We're going to give full custody to the father. Abby in her toughest moment in the trial then has to suffer that not only indignity, but that huge emotional trial of losing her son. But she's
a very determined person who indeed made some extremely questionable decisions.
Yes. And then finally, the other major player in this case is the prosecuting attorney, Shauna Gooden. And you can almost sense the tectonic shift when she knows that what appeared to be a likely victory for her is slipping through her fingers as both Abby and Will argue for the plea to be first-degree murder. And she's jumping out of her seat. She's objecting to let that. Could we go into that? Because she plays an important role, and she's kind of a counterpoise, if you will, to Abby, the prosecuting attorney, Shauna. And Shauna is almost everything that Abby isn't. But Abby, on the other hand, as an attorney, has a wily, savvy, street smart sense about her that Shauna, who's the more classic prosecutor, just doesn't have, and kind of gets outfoxed. And you see that frustration. She knows she's getting outfoxed right there in the courtroom before the judge as the plea is being discussed.
I was really determined to make Shauna a complicated character too, but also, most importantly, a very ethical, traditional prosecutor, as you say.
Yes.
And one thing that I learned from being a federal public defender up against assistant United States attorneys is that they did tend to have a more traditional approach to trying a case. And that's in part because they have the burden of proof. They have to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury. And their job really is to do that. And that puts a lot of constraints on them. And they're subject to constraints and ethical rules that defense attorneys are not. And the defense attorneys have a different job. All they have to do is raise reasonable doubt. And sometimes that means poking a hole in just one part of a case. And so because the job is so different, it lends itself to a lot more creativity and street smarts. And I think that's what I wanted to showcase, which is that people think that prosecutors and defense lawyers are flip sides of the same coin, but they're actually not. They have very different duties and responsibilities and ethical obligations.
Mm-hmm. In the few remaining minutes left in our podcast here today, Lara, I'd like to focus on the writing process. As we discussed earlier, as an attorney, of course, writing skills are a sine qua non, if you will, for being an attorney. But it's a different kind of writing style. And to transition from an attorney's writing style to a fiction writer's style, could you give us a sense of how the two styles are different, how you made the transition, And who helped you in that process of making the transition to being a fiction writer?
They are very different styles of writing. They're almost completely different from each other, truly. And I don't think I could have written this book if I hadn't had a writer's group to be a part of. And I was incredibly lucky that for years when I was living in LA and writing early drafts of this book, I was in a group with four other women who were not lawyers, who were full-time writers. And they all had very different styles and experiences, but one thing that they knew how to do was write a compelling narrative. And that was something that I really did not know how to do outside of a legal brief. And so I was extremely fortunate to get the benefit of their very pointed, thorough critiques. And in fact, one of them gave me a critique of the book more recently, closer in time to its publication. And I ended up taking most of her editorial suggestions. And I think that the book is much better off because of it.
And again, on the subject of process, of course, full-time job, raising young kids, a lot going on in your life. How many hours a week or a month did you devote to your writer's group and to actually sitting down and just doing the work of writing?
Any of your listeners who are aspiring writers, I hesitate to lay down the law and say you have to be a certain kind of writer. I've heard people who are very successful writers say, I always write 1,000 words a day.
Right.
I always sit in the chair for 3 hours a day. And I find that so daunting as a standard to live up to and just not really possible for me given everything else that I have going on in my life. And so what I tried to do was work on it in bursts, and in particular during breaks, winter break and summer break in my teaching schedule. And also, because I'm no longer with my husband, we're divorced, I would try to use the time that I had when he had custody of our children to get as much of it done as I could. But it would not be correct at all to say that I sat down every day or even once or twice a week. There would be times where I worked on it quite a bit, and then there would be weeks where I just had too much going on and I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, and also the profiling of these very complex characters, Abby, Luz, Shauna, Will, did you profile them out before you sat down? Was it an organic process that as you were writing, their characteristics came forward and manifested themselves depending on the scene? How did you go about creating these characters? Did you profile them ahead of time? Was it organic? Curious to know.
Some of it was ahead of time, certainly, and some of it was organic. One of my favorite things about getting deep into a novel is that the characters really do start to talk to me. So
yes.
If I'm sometimes standing in line in the grocery store or running a couple of miles or just sort of off in space, they'll start talking.
Uh-huh.
And that, to me, is one of my favorite parts of being a writer, which is just having this dialogue with your characters. And so it would sort of grow in my mind over time. But I think that the character who changed the most is Luz. And I do have a friend from my writer's group who read a late draft and said, this person isn't developed enough. She's too flat. You really need to do X, Y, and Z thing. And I actually, after I got that critique from Raina, I added some scenes with Luz. And I feel like it is a better book because of that.
Now tell us, Abby's such an engaging, larger-than-life, for a petite lady, she's a larger-than-life personality. So is Abby going to make a comeback? Are we going to see Abby in a sequel or a series of books about Abby and the exploits of Abby?
I sure hope so. She really is, in the words of Mr. Estrada, a holy terror. And I do picture her coming back, creative and wily and vigorous and zealous as ever. I hope so.
And then finally, what are you currently working on?
You said, and finally.
And finally, what are you currently working on? If hopefully Abby comes back at some point in the future, are you currently working on another book?
I am. So I'm finishing a nonfiction book that is slated to be published in 2022. It's called Ambitious Like a Mother. In the meantime, while I'm waiting to get my edits back, I have started a new novel, but it does not involve Abby. It's different lawyers and different figures and a totally different kind of case.
Very good. I want to thank Laura Bazelon for being our guest today and for sharing her insights on the writing process, for having created a very engaging story called The Good Mother. Thoroughly recommend it to my listeners. Once again, Laura, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for taking the time to explain the writing process, the creation of your characters, and coming up with a really winning narrative.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. It was just a real pleasure to be able to get to talk to you in such depth. And as a fellow writer, I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Laura. And for my listeners, please take a moment to visit our website, www.thesanfranciscoexperiencepodcast.com, and subscribe to the podcast. It's free to do so, and by subscribing, all future episodes will come directly to your inbox. You can also listen to all 157 past episodes. You can read my blog, peruse my book, send me an email, or leave me a comment. This has been the San Francisco Experience, with your host, Jim Herlihy, reporting from America's favorite city, San Francisco.